imperialist intervention. Eritrea also has a long history of solidarity with the Palestinian people, dating at least as far back to its independence struggle. So Eritrea and the Palestinian Liberation Organization and the general Palestinian freedom struggle were really close allies throughout the latter half of the 20th century. Israel, on the other hand, took the side of Ethiopia, which was under a very repressive regime during the time that was repressive not only to the Eritreans who were fighting for their independence, but also for many of the peoples within Ethiopia. So Israel has this history of intervening in the Horn of Africa against the interests of the Eritrean people, as well as the interests of the Ethiopian people as well.
Eritrea is strategically located in the Horn of Africa on the Red Sea and the Bab-el-Mandeb Strait, making it a geopolitically strategic and important state along the world's busiest shipping lane. Eritrea's Foreign Minister Osman Saleh Mohammed believes that the unipolar world order is coming to an end and that the conflicts in Africa are instigated by external powers.
In as far as global trends is concerned, I had stated, and I quote, the world is on the cusp of a new world order. All vital parameters indicate that the unipolar world order has come to an end or is in its twilight year. The economic power balance is inexorably changing with a spike in attendant intense rivalries and upheavals.
What are the implications for the Israeli regime following Eritrea's rejection of its envoy, particularly considering the strategic importance of this country?
As you mentioned, Eritrea is located on the Red Sea. It straddles, you know, it's right between these two parts of the world. It's not so far from Yemen and the countries of the Gulf, but it's also part of the African continent. So the Horn of Africa is very much like a gateway into the rest of Africa from Israel's point of view, based off of where Israel is located. So by not having access to Eritrea in this way, it prevents Israel in some way that blocks Israel off from the rest of the continent. And Israel has had a long history of intervention, not just in the Horn, but other parts of Africa, solidarity with the apartheid regime of South Africa historically, intervention in Uganda as well in the 70s. But through not having access to Eritrea, which would be one of the closest points of access into the African continent for Israel, it's a step back in terms of being able to penetrate directly and access these other parts of the continent as well.
Last year, at least 14 countries, including Eritrea, vehemently opposed Israeli regime's observer status at the African Union and agreed to expel it from the 55-member bloc. Now, a leading Pan-Africanist, PLO Lumumba, says he sees no merit in the Israeli regime being an observer member of the African Union.
I find no merit in Israel enjoying observer status at the African Union. And thirdly, I am puzzled why that is important at all. I do not see any value at all that is added by Israel enjoying observer status at the AU, unless there are certain subterranean political interests which are at play in this particular matter.
Activists in African countries have been working to intensify their struggle against Israeli regime's apartheid practices against Palestinians. These activists say Israel must be isolated the same way that apartheid South Africa was sanctioned. In February, the African Union suspended the debate on whether to withdraw Israel's accreditation as an observer to the bloc. The move by Eritrea to reject Israeli regime's ambassador is seen as a pointer of further isolation of the regime in Africa.
We certainly hope so, and I do believe that Israel's relationship with Africa as a whole is really on shaky grounds. It's not something that's very stable or sustainable because it's very unpopular with the majority of the people who are living within Africa. Because Israel has such a close relationship to a lot of the countries that have historically intervened, and even in recent times intervened for regime change in Africa, because of, you know, Israel's relationship to the United States, France, the UK, and other colonial and neocolonial powers, it means that sometimes African countries don't always act within the interests of their people, as well as their own national interests in, as a whole. But because of how generally unpopular Israel is in Africa among the people, it is really hard to, this sort of relationship would be really, really hard to defend and sustain. So Eritrea leading the fight against the normalization of this sort of relationship is really significant.
The Israeli regime is known to meddle in the internal affairs of African countries in a bid to push its nefarious agenda. Now, recently, the regime's notorious Mossad spy agency was implicated in a plot to overthrow the government of the Democratic Republic of Congo. Now, is Eritrea at risk of being destabilized by the Israeli regime?
Eritrea is going to do everything it can to maintain its sovereignty, which it's demonstrated time and time again that it prioritizes its own sovereignty in the face of a world that is, you know, dominated by Western imperialism. And then in this sort of vein, Israel's allyship with the Western imperialists. So Eritrea is going to try everything to guard its own sovereignty, but it is threatened for regime change already by Israel and ally states. So we see U.S. sanctions on Eritrea as one example of this. So there's already an effort to try to destabilize Eritrea in this way. And this is something that is at risk. The risk is intensified by this decision to reject Israel. Because Eritrea is on such a divided continent, and there is a lack of concrete African unity on a political level, it really does make the risk heightened in a lot of ways.
Addressing the African Union summit held in Addis Ababa last February, Palestinian Prime Minister urged African countries to reject the Israeli regime due to the apartheid policies it imposes on Palestinians.
Israel should never be rewarded for its violation and for the apartheid regime it does impose on the Palestinian people. As an entity, Israel has progressed from extremism to militarism to colonial expansion.
Eritrea and other African countries have for long supported the liberation of Palestinian territories occupied by the Israeli regime. So why is the liberation of Palestine important for African countries?
The liberation of Palestine is super important for African people and for the liberation of the African continent. If you look at historically, we see that almost pretty much all of the revolutionary struggles, all of the struggles that were in line with the people in Africa, whether it's the Eritrean struggle for their independence, whether it's Thomas Sankara in Burkina Faso, whether it's the struggle of the peoples of South Africa against apartheid and also against settler colonialism and these things, we see that the people are always on the side of Palestine because we recognize that the history is very, very similar. It's a history of colonialism. It's a history of imperialism, of exploitation, and of occupation. It's the same enemies. Israel was created through the United Kingdom or by the United Kingdom. During this epoch of the British Empire, the same British Empire that dominated the majority of Africa during the late 19th, 20th century. So we have this shared history of struggle against oppression.
Well, there you have it. The shared history of the struggle against colonialism and imperialism is a factor in Africa's opposition to the Israeli regime and support for Palestinian independence struggle. I'd like to thank our guest, the co-founder of Thomas Sankara Center for African Liberation and Unity, for her insight today. We now take a short break before our next topic, which is on the drought ravaging Sudan. So stay with us.
Drought ravaging Sudan.
Aid agencies say millions in Sudan will struggle to access food in the coming months, including 3.1 million people facing emergency levels of hunger. Displaced children and their families, refugees and people directly impacted by conflict are likely to be most vulnerable to hunger.
The ongoing crisis has been exacerbated by a worsening economic situation, recurring violence throughout many states, a poor harvest, and the global price shocks in the fuel, grains and other food commodities.
Sudanese farmers are struggling to find new crops as the government has failed to buy their harvest under promised terms. A Sudanese farmer says they are facing a difficult situation.
The summer season is threatened with collapse. 50%, 70% of us might not plant. And that puts the food supply in question. Farmers are in a difficult position. People are in a difficult position. The situation has become very difficult.
Now, to discuss the food security situation in Sudan, we contacted Adel Abdelati, the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. Now, aid agencies say Sudan is facing a severe shortage of food and medicines, leading to the spread of malnutrition and diseases. Now, is the situation getting worse in this country?
Yes, unfortunately, Sudan is facing a big shortage of food. Sudan is importing wheat from Ukraine and from Russia. And we know that now there is no supplies from these two countries. And about 18 million of people are facing the danger of hunger and shortage of food. This situation should be addressed and should be solved as soon as possible, because otherwise we will have a humanitarian crisis in Sudan.
Thousands of protesters continue to organize massive protests in Sudan's capital and other parts of the country in demonstrations against the country's ruling military generals. A Sudanese protester says they will continue with street demonstrations to ensure that remnants of the former regime don't remain in power.
We believe this revolution needs to be monitored so as not to be hijacked by members of the former regime or even by political parties.
Apart from the Ukraine crisis, has the political instability in Sudan contributed to the food shortage in the country?
That is true. The instability in the country, of course, a situation where there is lack of security, there is lack of stability on the political level. There is no, in fact, government. We don't have a prime minister. We don't have a government which has some kind of popular support. And all the time we have demonstrations. And in fact, we have a failed government and a failed state. And this, of course, is worsening the situation. Also, bad economic decisions, because farmers in Sudan, they have collected a very good collection of wheat in this year. But the policies of the government and the policies of the Agriculture Bank, by forcing non-commercial, non-rental, prices for the Sudanese wheat has resulted in farmers refusing to sell their products.
A joint report from the World Food Programme and the Food and Agriculture Organization last June concluded that 15 million people in Sudan face acute food insecurity. These UN agencies say projections for later in the year indicate that this might be increasing to some 18 million people.
WFP Sudan has just completed its food security assessment. Unfortunately, our worst fears have been confirmed. We estimate at this point in time that some 15 million people are going hungry in Sudan. Our projections for later in the year indicate that this might be increasing to some 18 million people.
NATO's imperialism, military expansionism, which ignited the Ukraine conflict, has disrupted global food supply and worsened the food crisis for African countries. These U.S.-led NATO countries have spent billions of dollars in military assistance to Ukraine while ignoring appeals by U.N. agencies for emergency funds to alleviate the suffering of tens of millions in need of urgent food aid. Sudan is one of the countries facing inadequate international response to the drought situation.
The response of the international community is not enough. Of course, there was alert from the international organization dealing with food security, dealing with health, But these alerts finished with only alerting, and there was no quick response from international community, international relief organizations. And before all, there was no good response from the government.
Sudan's Minister of Trade and Supply, Amal Saleh Saad, recently called for agricultural investments in the country and for the exploitation of the vast Sudanese agricultural lands, adding that the country could serve as a food basket for other countries in the region. Now, Sudan is a country blessed with abundant water resources and fertile soils, and was once referred to as Africa's emerging bread basket. So what really went wrong?
That is true that Sudan has a lot of water resources, a very fertilized land, and a very hardworking people, farmers. And this could be a good assist for Sudan to be one of the leaders in Africa, if not in the whole world, in providing food and food security for its citizens and for Africa. But the problem is a bad governance. The problem is political before all. Sudan has lacked security, has lacked stability for the last, we can say, 33 years. After the toppling of Bashir, we did not have stable government. We have like for 2 years, a mixed government of civilian and military, but also it was a very weak government. Now we have a military government which is faced by a very strong opposition from young people, from political parties. And in this situation, you can't manage the country in a good way.
Now, so what measures can be taken to restore Sudan's glory as an agricultural country capable of meeting its needs and exporting food to other African countries?
The first step is to settle the political crisis and to build a stable government, a government with some kind of popular support and political support, because the military alone could not rule the country, and they have big challenges to maintain stability and security. The second measure is to allocate money for investing in agriculture sector, and before all, to provide very quick support to farmers in order to supply the market with food products and with agriculture products. Also, there should be a good supporting policies for agriculture in the country, and concentrating on transforming the agriculture from traditional agriculture to industrial agriculture.
Well, democratically elected government and massive investment in agriculture are critical if Sudan is to use its potential as Africa's breadbasket. That's the opinion of our guest today, Adil Abdel Achi, the chairman of the Sudan of the Future Political Bloc. I'd like to thank him for his incisive analysis today. Well, that brings us to the end of yet another edition of Africa Today. It was great having you watch the show today. Please let us know what you think by dropping us a line through our social media. And goodbye for now.
Stories from the past. Stories from the lives of the infallibles. Stories from different parts of the world. On the Lantern.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the most compassionate, the most merciful, dear friends, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, you are listening to Lantern. We have an interesting story. Today's story entitled Habib ibn Mazahir. He was about the same age as Imam Hussein. They were childhood friends. When Hazrat Ali moved the capital to Kufa, Habib also moved to Kufa. He stayed on in Kufa and became a prominent citizen. He was a devout Shia. The first letter which Imam Hussein received inviting him to Kufa was signed by Habib ibn Mazahir. After Muslim ibn Aghil was killed by Ibn Ziyad, Kufa was sealed off. No one could get in or out of the city without the governor's permission. Habib ibn Mazahir was heartbroken because he could not join Imam al-Hussein. He did not even know where Imam al-Hussein was. There were all sorts of rumors, but no one knew anything for certain. Imam Hussein had reached Karbala. On 4th of Muharram, Imam Hussein wrote a letter to Habib ibn Mazahir, his childhood friend, telling him how Yazid's vultures were gathering to kill him. The letter was carried by a messenger who entered Kufa in the dark by climbing over the city walls. The messenger reached Habib's house. As Habib, his wife and his young son were sitting down for breakfast. Habib read the letter, kissed it, and tears began to flow down his cheeks. His wife asked him what was wrong. Habib said, "Who would ever have thought that people would be so thirsty for the blood of the grandson of the Holy Prophet, whose name they're uttering every adhan and in every salah?" At Asr, in the evening, when most people were in the mosque, Habib slipped out of Kufa. He mounted his horse and galloped towards Karbala. Habib ibn Mazahir reached Karbala late in the evening. Imam Hussein greeted Habib with great affection. On the fateful day of Ashura, between Zuhr and Asr, Habib ibn Mazahir rode into the battlefield. He fought bravely. Finally, he was overpowered. He fell to ground. Imam Hussein rushed to him. Habib looked at Imam and said, "O the grandson of the Holy Prophet, please forgive this humble servant for not being able to give more than his unworthy life for you and Islam." The Imam took Habib in his arms and cried, "Oh, my friend, oh, my friend." Habib was killed, resting his head on Imam's shoulder. Dear brothers and sisters, accept our sorrow and condolences on the month of Muharram. I invite you to listen to the continuation of this program, Lantern.
Dr. Fakhr Rohani.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Wa bi nasta'in. In this episode, we are going to be concerned with certain aspects of the life and times of Habib ibn Mazahir al-Asadi, who was one of the Ashura martyrs in Karbala. In the beginning, it must be indicated that Habib ibn Mazahir, he was a renowned companion of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam. He was born a year before the prophethood of the Prophet Muhammad. And throughout the time of the Prophet Muhammad, he was felicitous to meet up with the Prophet in Mecca. And that is from the earlier period of the advent of Islam. At that time, on the day of Ashura, he was at the age of 75. When he was martyred. However, his being associated with the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam and his being a close companion of the Prophet led him to continue that line of companionship, and he associated himself with Imam Ali alayhi salam and with the second infallible Imam Al-Hasan ibn Ali alayhi salam. At the same time, Habib ibn Mazahir al-Asadi was very much devoted to the house of the Prophet Muhammad. According to a reliable account, when he was playing with the grandsons of the Prophet Muhammad sallallahu alaihi wasallam, once the Prophet noticed that Habib was very much devoted to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, And the Prophet Muhammad noticed that Habib took some dust from the legs of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and put it on his eyes and on his forehead. And he did this because of his full devotion to Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. At that time, the Prophet Muhammad, who noticed, I mean, this gesture of Habib, got closer to him and patted him on the head and respected him. And then the Prophet Muhammad indicated that he had received a piece of news from the Archangel Gabriel in that Habib al-Muzahir would be a close companion of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam on the plain of Ashura.
Lantern.
Under the light of lantern, we'll look at the story, which indicates a moral aspects of our life.
At the same time, it must be indicated that such a person, such a personality like Habib ibn Muzahir received his education, his religious education from the Prophet Muhammad, with whom he was associated, and also he received much knowledge from Imam Ali alayhi salam. The same personality that is Habib ibn Muzahir he was gratified to be a learned person regarding the forthcoming events. In his lifetime, he prophesied some future events, and all of them came true. And this was because he had been given this kind of knowledge. On the day of Ashura, Habib ibn Muzahir, although he was an old man, I mean, at the age of 75, he was very brave, and he never withdrew. First of all, he gave pieces of advice to the enemy soldiers under Umar ibn Sa'd. However, when Umar ibn Sa'd and his swordsmen started teasing the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, Habib ibn Muzahir got very angry, and he intended to answer them. However, as in the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam, nobody wanted to be one of those who initiated the Battle of Ashura, Habib ibn Muzahir al-Asadi didn't do anything. However, he never forgot that the enemy soldiers started teasing Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam and making fun of the camp of Imam al-Hussein alayhi salam. Thank you.
That was all for today. Thank you very much for joining us. Inshallah, we continue this topic on the next episode. Till then, may Allah bless all of you. Fi amanillah. Ala bi dhikrillahi
tatma'innul qulub. Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Tawakkul comes from the root word wakala. Wakala means...
Today, I'd like to read to you an excerpt from...
Allah is the unique Arabic name.
Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala has decreed.
His decree, though, we learn...
This is Foresight, a program on how to worship Allah.
Ya khaliqa kulli shay'in wa waritha.
So, dear friends, we are talking about how there are certain pitfalls or certain negative end results when we do not conduct our ubudiyya, our servitude, our worship, and our servitude, to Allah in the proper prescribed manner. Now, of course, this spiritual wayfaring, this sayr suluk, this divine spiritual journey is, of course, full of pitfalls. It's full of barriers. Otherwise, it would not be a journey. It would be a vacation. So this is not a spiritual vacation. It is a spiritual journey. It is a spiritual path. It is something which has hurdles. It has obstacles. It has pitfalls. It has trials, tribulations, and difficulties. It has different kind of tests, physical and spiritual. But that should not dissuade us from doing these acts of worship, and it should not dissuade us from continuing this spiritual journey, because, of course, the ultimate end of this spiritual journey is salvation, it is eternal success, it is the satisfaction of Allah. But when it comes to some of these pitfalls, of course, we have to be very careful. Certain things happen in this spiritual journey, and there are things which every single one of us has to cross through. For example, self-conceitedness, self-conceit, self-centeredness, and selfishness. This is one thing that can happen to an individual on this path. It is one of those pitfalls. And this, of course, is related with pride and arrogance and haughtiness and egotism. These are all aspects connected to one another, similar to one another, but every single one of them a dangerous pitfall upon this path and this spiritual journey towards Allah.
The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come. The crescent has now arrived, casting gloom on Karbala, casting gloom on Karbala. The moon of Muharram, times of sadness have come.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
There is a narration by Sheikh Saduq in Uyun Akhbar al-Ridha, where in the year 352 after Hijrah, he actually talks about which year he heard this narration from his source. And then he has four individuals who take him to the ninth Imam. So from Sanad point of view, this is a very good hadith where the narrators between the Ma'asum and Sheikh are only four individuals. So this is time-wise very important hadith where he goes to the ninth Imam, and then ninth Imam quotes a statement going through his forefathers to Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, but not directly. He stops with Imam Hussain alayhi salam, and then he says, Hussain ibn Ali said, that one day I went to my grandfather while there was somebody sitting with him, one of his companions by the name of Ubay bin Ka'ab. And when my grandfather saw me, Rasulullah saw me, he said, Marhaba bika ya Aba Abdullah. Oh, Aba Abdullah, you know, welcome. Remember, among the Arab society, even a child can be given, you know, kunya, Abu Abdullah, although he was not yet married, didn't have a son by the name of Abdullah. But this was very common in the Arab society. So he says, Marhaba bika ya Aba Abdullah. And then he says, Ya Zayna Samawati wal Ardeen. Not only O Aba Abdullah, welcome, O the one who is the beauty and adornment of the heavens and the earth. So Ubay bin Ka'ab was surprised. He says, you know, وَكَيْفَ يَكُونَ يَا رَسُولَ اللَّهِ زَيْنَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْعَرْضِ أَحَدٌ غَيْرُكَ. How is it possible that anybody can become زَيْنَ السَّمَاوَاتِ وَالْعَرْضِ other than you? You know, you are greater than him, of course. You know, he's a Nabi Rasul and he's the grandfather there. This is where the Prophet responds to him by saying, Ya Ubay, Walladhi ba'athani bilhaqqi nabiyyin. In the name of the God who has raised me as a Nabi, Inna al-Husayn bin Ali fi sama akbaru minhu fil ard. You don't know the status of Husayn bin Ali. It is greater in the heavens than it is in the earth. Because he says, and referring to his journey to Mi'raj, he says, فَإِنَّهُ لَمَكْتُوبٌ عَنْ يَمِينِ عَرْشِ اللَّهِ. He says, on the right side of the throne of Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala in the heavens, there is a writing which says about him that he is Misbahul Huda wa Safinatu Najat. Even today, Hussein is Misbahul Huda for us. He is this torch or the lamp of guidance. Anyone, and I use these terms, you know, many times when we see the theological differences among the Muslims. People say, what do I do? Do I go and study the Quran and the Hadith and history? You know, those are the right and valid way of going and looking at differences and finding out what is a better path in Islam. But a shorter way would be to go to Karbala, to look at the tragedy which happened on that day. And this is where you will come to realize that, you know, it will be a surprise for anyone who studies the story of Karbala. Because they will be surprised that there were 25 to 30,000 people saying, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah. Yet they are the ones who end up killing, brutally killing the grandson of the Prophet. Not only that, you know him, his family members, making the granddaughters of the Prophet their own prisoners, parading them in the streets of Kufa and Damascus. And he was... This will force you to think, why? Within 50 years of the passing away of the Prophet, what happened? What were the factors which led these people to do this? And this is where you will be forced to, you know, look at the issue. That who facilitated directly and indirectly emergence of Ali Abu Sufyan? That a person like Yazid comes to power. And this is where you'll come to realize that, you know, this was directly, indirectly done by those who came before. And this is where you come to realize that, well, you know, there are two ways of looking at the Islam of Muhammad. One is through the eyes of the Sahaba, and the other is through the eyes of Ahlul Bayt. And so even just thinking about the tragedy of Karbala can lead you to know what is the path, because when you see the fruits of two different paths in Karbala, it is easy to know who is Haqq and who is Batil. Our sixth Imam has a statement where he says, Kulluna sufunun najat. Each one of us from the Imams are ark of salvation in our own right. Everyone from Ali to the 12th Imam. But then he says something very amazing about Hussein. He says, وَلَكِنْ سَفِينَةُ جَدِّ الْحُسَيْنِ. But he says there is something in that safina and ark of salvation of my grandfather Hussein, that safina and that ark, أَوْسَعْ وَفِي لُجَلِ الْبِحَارِ أَسْرَعْ. It is wider than all the other arks of salvation. And it's faster when it goes through the waves of the sea. And this is where, you know, the Imam, sixth Imam, is talking about this Safina of Hussein, that it is awsa' wa asra', It is wider than other safinas, and it is, you know, faster in its movement. And this is where we see, you know, people really would like to get onto this safina of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. And this is where we see, you know, people really would like to get onto this safina of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salatu wassalam. And that is because of the ultimate, you know, sacrifice that he has given. Nobody had reached to that level. And that is why even the title of Sayyid al-Shuhada, which was given to Hamza, the uncle of the Prophet, was then, you know, in a way shifted after Karbala to the personality of Hussein ibn Ali alayhi salatu wassalam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
Welcome back, dear listeners. In continuation to what we were saying, which were some of these pitfalls that we were talking about, pitfalls that can occur upon this spiritual journey. Of course, we had said that the spiritual journey towards the Almighty Allah is relatively full of difficulties and hardships. But that does not mean that we should be afraid of those difficulties or hardships. Rather, we should be steadfast in the face of these trials and tribulations so that we can attain our ultimate goal, which is the satisfaction and the nearness to Allah. Of course, this satisfaction and nearness to Allah is the whole purpose of ubudiyah, our servitude and our obedience, and our worship to Allah. In one of the previous programs, many, many programs ago, we had said that very humbly, that even if we were not to get anything in return, physical or material or spiritual, in return for our ubudiyah to Allah, of course Allah is worthy of ubudiyah, even if we were to not receive anything in return. Talking about the pitfalls, of course, we talked about selfishness, conceit, egotism, arrogance, pride. But then there's others. For example, a person can become ill-tempered. A person can become distrusting of other servants of Allah. A person can become slanderous. A person can begin to show off. A person can begin to take advantage of other people. Now, of course, every single one of these attributes, negative attributes, has a discussion within itself. But the main point is that we should be very careful of these various pitfalls that can really hamper our spiritual journey. And in some cases, for example, in arrogance or pride, it can really lead to our destruction. So we must always be careful to not fall into these things. And of course, there are plenty of books about ethics and morality and akhlaq, as it is known in Arabic, which can help us to navigate through this very difficult maze of moral and ethical virtues and moral and ethical pitfalls in order for us to be able to increase, strengthen, and level up our ubudiyah, our servitude, our obedience, and our worship to Allah. Hussein, Hussein. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of Foresight. Don't forget to visit our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode and another great tip, fi aman Allah, and God bless you all.
In the limelight.
We may be in the dying days of the fossil fuel empire, but those companies are enriching themselves like never before, as people die from our climate crisis, says Andy Rowell Ryder in an article published under the heading, Amid Climate Crisis, Shell's Financial Windfall is Profiteering at its Most Grotesque. Stay tuned for more. Oil giant Shell has just posted record profits for a second consecutive quarter, smashing its previous record from earlier this year. Shell posted adjusted earnings of a staggering $11.5 billion for the second quarter of this year, beating $9.1 billion from the first 3 months of 2022. Europe's largest oil group was boosted by the skyrocketing energy prices caused by the Eastern Europe's crisis. This means in the first 6 months of this year, the oil giant has earnings of over $20 billion. This is profiteering at its most greedy and grotesque. Ironically, the company even produced less oil than in the first quarter, but raked in record profits due to the crisis in Eastern Europe. What it is doing with these record profits is also interesting. In a move that surprised many analysts, the company said it was putting $6 billion of these profits into a share buyback scheme, which rewards shareholders. This fact was not lost on the company's critics, who pointed out that the company was enriching itself and shareholders and not investing in renewables. Shell was not alone in reporting record earnings. Its French rival, Total Energies, also reported record profits of $9.8 billion in the quarter. Tomorrow, it is expected that ExxonMobil and Chevron will report record profits too. The oil industry's obscene profits come as millions of people face a cost of living crisis. In the UK, at least energy bills are expected to rise again in the coming months. One estimate is that they could hit nearly GBP 4,700 a year by early next year. Influential commentators on Twitter were quick to criticize the obscene profits and the contrast to millions struggling to pay food and energy bills across the U.S. The situation is predicted to get so bad that financial experts are warning that intervention is needed. As Platform says, the system is broken. We may be in the dying days of the fossil fuel empire, but those companies are enriching themselves like never before as American people die from climate crisis and die this winter from lack of food and heating. Families will be destitute across the U.S., and all the while politicians sit idly by. The situation cannot be allowed to continue.
Questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing of our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. A very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is a program wherein we provide you with necessary information to be able to provide necessary grounds for your children to flourish and to attain perfection, which is the ultimate goal of Islam. Well, today in our studio, we have with us Brother Miqdad. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
Brother Miqdad is a researcher in the Hafza Elmi of Qom, who will be providing us answers on the basis of Noble Quran and the narrations of Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. A very warm welcome, brother.
Thank you so much. Jazakallah.
As everybody knows that teenagers are a very crucial stage, and when parents are dealing with the teenagers, does father and mother have a different role when dealing with teenagers?
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So this is a very important question regarding the differences between a father and a mother. And I guess this discussion is very general as well. It can be approached in a very general way. When it comes to the discussion of upbringing and tarbiyah, we talk about how a role of a father in a family and the role of a mother in a family is in some ways similar, in some other ways it's different.
Okay.
And there are ways that there are things that the father does that a mother doesn't, and vice versa. I'd like to discuss this very briefly. Obviously, we can mention many things. Inshallah, I'll just touch upon a few of them, specifically
okay.
related to this kind of later age of a child's life, teenagers basically.
Okay.
But before I do that, let me mention a very general kind of discussion on the type of parenting that we can have. And based on that, inshallah, I'll move on to the differences between a father and a mother, which is what the question is about.
Mm-hmm.
So when we look at type of parenting, you can say that there's kind of three types of parenting, generally, you could say. One of them is the kind of parenting where the expectations are very low.
Okay.
And the giving is also very low. So the both what's coming in, what's coming out, both of them are very low. They're kind of not caring parents, basically. So those kind of parents who send their kids to school and don't really care what's happening in school. In the afternoon, the kids are mainly just watching TV and doing their own things. What the parents expect from their children is very low. They don't really expect too much from the children. As long as they're well-fed and they're happy children generally, they're not complaining too much and they're not asking for too much money from their pocket. They're happy parents, basically, in terms of their children. And on the other side as well, children are not giving too much as well because the expectation of the parents is very low. These young adults, youth, are not really giving in too much. And they're not going to be growing or interacting or working so much on themselves. So this is low expectation, low giving. The second type is where you have dictatorship kind of parents, where the expectation is very high.
Okay.
And at the same time, the expectation is very high. The response from the children is also going to be very low. Why? Because with the expectations that are higher than the capacity of the child, there's also very little room for giving in, very little room for understanding the child's need.
All right.
So you find these kind of parents, basically, they want their children to have 20 out of 20 in school in every single class of them, or to have A stars everywhere. They expect the child to come back from school and be reading the Quran and reading 3-4 books at a time, and also doing a lot of exercise, also clean up their room and cleaning up the whole house as well, and praying on time and sleeping on time. And they've got a whole schedule for their child.
What they expect from a child.
They expect a huge amount of things from a child, not giving in so much, not understanding the needs of the child.
I'll be talking to you after a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIP English Radio.
Hey, stop! I got a favorite game!
IRIP English Radio presents a priceless gift to parents. Do you have problem with your kids?
I have two boys. One is 5-year-old and the other one is 3.5. And they constantly fight and wrestle with each other, and it often gets to a dangerous stage.
My 18-month-old daughter has learned to eat by herself, and she just refuses that I feed her. But usually, all the food basically goes everywhere except her mouth. So how can we allow this strife to happen for the purpose of freedom?
Don't worry. We're here to help.
For a child, the purpose of the food is only to feed. It's also for him to learn. It's also for him to explore and fulfill the need of curiosity, fulfill the need of freedom.
Islamic upbringing. Contact us. EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. This is Islamic Upbringing. We are talking about the role of father and mother in the teenager's life. Yes, brother, you were saying that they are dictator kind of parents who expect a lot from their children and they're not giving in much input.
What we need to do and understand is that a true and a very balanced approach is what we need to kind of have in our family, where the expectations must be reasonable expectations based on the reality of the situation, of the child's needs, the child's abilities and potential. At the same time, there's also always room for flexibility. And once you understand this, you realize that when we're dealing with teenagers, you have clear expectations and you also have clear red lines. And you build a bridge based on respect and love to make sure that whilst the expectations are met, and whilst the clear red lines basically are maintained, okay, there's also this atmosphere of very strong love, very strong respect, basically. And this requires both parents to be in synchrony with this. So both father and mother ensure that they expect from the child an amount that is according to the child's needs and capacity and potential.
True.
At the same time, they've cleared out those expectations. They've made sure that the child knows about these expectations. And also they've cleared out the red lines as well, that this is the thing we don't accept in this house, for example. This is the kind of lines we won't cross. So I expect you to kind of stay in these boundaries.
All right.
Just to give an example, for example, being out of the house after 10 p.m.